Hello, I'm Hala Mahiuddin. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, the country that once saw itself as a 100 million all-middle-class society is finally acknowledging its economic policy of the last decade has bred inequality. Can Japan's new prime minister bridge the gap between rich and poor? Getting 164 governments on board for more equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines. We talked to the Director General of the World Trade Organization on how she plans to do this. And saffron is considered Indian-administered Kashmir's red gold, but climate change and drought-like conditions are hurting the lucrative business. Well, for the first time in 40 years, Save the Children has been handing out food parcels to the poorest people in Japan. It's not an isolated case. Rich countries have seen a rise in the use of food banks due to the pandemic. Japan's new Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida, has acknowledged the failure of trickle-down economics for the widening inequality gap between rich and poor. He's taking aim at his predecessor's economic plan that has reshaped the Japanese economy over the last decade. The country's poverty rate is the second highest among G7 nations. Its household income fell by 3.5% from 2014 to 2019. But the top 10% of the wealthiest saw an increase. And the average wage has hardly grown in the past 10 years, with an increase of just 1.2% from 2012 through to last year. The average annual salary stood at around $38,500. That's almost 45% less than the average annual wage in the US, where inequality is more pronounced. According to Kishida, he plans to create what he calls a virtuous economy. That effectively means raising income for a broader range of people to trigger consumption. The Prime Minister has announced a record stimulus package of more than $490 billion to help the country recover from the pandemic. It's the largest to date and expected to increase output, although it means increasing its debt burden. Well, the package includes financial aid for businesses affected by the coronavirus health crisis and the slump in demand. Around $880 cash handouts to households with children and those aged 18 or below. It also involves money for strengthening semiconductor supply chains, programs to encourage domestic tourism, and investment in a nationwide university fund. Kishida also plans to increase wages for some workers, including public health and medical staff. And he plans to give tax incentives for companies that raise pay. But despite Kishida's criticism of Abenomics, he is actually sticking to the policy's main three pillars, known as the three arrows. They include aggressive monetary easing, flexible fiscal policy, and a growth strategy. He will, however, move away from his predecessor's free market policies. And the Prime Minister has signalled a reform of corporate governance in favour of the small business sector. So will Japan's Prime Minister succeed in his mission? Well, Sujiro Takeshita is a professor at the School of Management and Information of Innovation and former Managing Director of Mizuho International. He joins me by Skype from Shizuoka in Japan. And it's great to have you with us on Counting the Cost. Let me start by asking about the Prime Minister's plan. Fumio Kishida says he will bring a new form of capitalism. What does this mean? And is it really any different from Abenomics?
Really good question, in the sense that, yes, he needs to bring up something new, especially considering the fact that he was not as popular as his arch-rival, Mr. Kono, amongst the Japanese public. But he was elected because he was popular amongst the Japanese LDP MPs. So obviously, he has to come up with, some kind of a new plan that would basically attract people's eyes. and basically to rectify the disparity that was caused by the COVID-19. And Japanese are quite sensitive to this issue. Although Japan's, I would say, disparity of wealth is rather low in amongst the OECD nations, people do not want to have such societal divide. So obviously, this is an area where he could tackle, or basically claim to tackle, considering the new form of, capitalism.
So would you say that this plan that he's presenting is a plan to regain trust among the political parties, or does it really represent radical reform in economic terms?
The latter, unfortunately, the answer is no. The reason why most of the Japanese LDP members, I would say the MPs, have chosen Mr. Kishida is because he will sustain the status quo. Mr. Kono is a much more radical, I would say, person who brings a lot of constructive destruction to the system. At least he was claiming to do that. Although Mr. Kishida is much more of, I would say, a adjuster. To answer your question, will he bring in something new? Will he bring in something that would basically change, alter the course of the Japanese methodology? I don't think so. I think he is much more of a person that is stuck to the status quo.
He's stuck to the status quo, and he is something of a fiscal conservative, it should be said. But do you think that this does represent something of a change in terms of a radical fiscal stimulus package? Because that is something that's quite different, is it not?
Yes, I mean, he obviously will come up with these fiscal packages. In fact, everybody was saying that, even the opposition. But the biggest question, which none of them answered, was considering our debt situation, which is the heaviest debt amongst all OECD nations, and considering our demographics, which basically means that we will have a very large number of senior citizens and very low birth rate. Can we afford to continue with this kind of policy of just talking about big presents and not talking about where the money is coming from? This is one of the big arguments that's not really been talked about enough in Japan. And this is where Mr. Kishida and other politicians do not want to be touched. Unfortunately, because of the COVID-19, people are used to this spending spree type of, policies. But I think, what Japan has to realize is the world do realize that one of the biggest weak points of Japan is this debt problem. And this is where I think politicians have to start talking about, putting some discipline into the system.
Is it just about controlling the debt and putting discipline into the system, or is it time to tackle other difficult subjects, for example, immigration?
Immigration is definitely one of them. SDG is another. We've got, loads of things which can make the transformational changes. And I think Japan has to move to that step. Unfortunately, the great thing about, Mr. Kishida and his follower is that, the transition of, I'll say, management will be smooth because he's had a very long experience with the bureaucrats and within the party. He's got very good ties, etc. But the flip side of that is if and when you want to make radical changes, you'll be faced with severe opposition from exactly people who have been supporting you. Can he have the guts and also, can he afford to basically sacrifice, his strength to make that transitional changes? I think that would be a very big question, because if he loses his strongest point, then it would be very difficult for him to administer further on.
And let's talk about the changes that he is making, and of course these payments that are going out to families. The aim, of course, is to boost consumption and to kickstart the economy that way. But will it work, particularly given the world is facing such an acute supply shortage?
I think the answer is simply no. I mean, we've done this before. The characteristics of Japanese consumption is that if you have to have a very good, I would say, environment of the corporate side, partly because of lifelong employment system, which is still there in amongst larger companies, and also the behavior of the Japanese, which is extremely conservative, which tend to basically stick to a very conservative nature in their spending patterns. So obviously, if they know that the macro environment, particularly their company side, is good, then they still start spending. But if they're just giving cash, what happened before is that it goes into savings. So if you look at the multiplier to the economy, I'm pretty sure that you're not going to get a very big deal by just, you know, throwing cash at them. The important thing is to rejuvenate the prolonged, I would say, conditions of the economy, which basically gives a much more a safeguard feeling for the consumers. But that said, of course, you know, for people who have been, you know, suffering very badly, the non-full-time employees, women in particular who are in the service sector, of course, they need cash. They're in a desperate situation. So, yes, it will be an emergency measures, but will it really be an ignition of consumer spending to kick off? The answer is definitely no.
Well, it will be fascinating to see how it all plays out. But for now, Seijiro Takeshito joining us from Shizuoka in Japan. Thank you so much for your analysis. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now, getting 164 member states to pull in the same direction has been a tall order for the World Trade Organization. Since its inception 26 years ago, the WTO has struggled to get consensus for some of the most pressing issues of our time. Now, as the global economy weathers a second year of the pandemic, its new director general hopes to make headway where others have failed. I'm delighted to say Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala joins me now from Geneva. She made history as the first woman and the first African to lead the World Trade Organization. Madam Director General, thank you so much for joining us here on Counting the Cost.
Thank you, Hala, for having me.
Let's start with the pandemic. One of the key root sites of the global pandemic has been hailed as the vaccines and vaccine programs. Many countries have vaccines. Many others simply don't have access to them. One proposed solution is waiving vaccine patents. Where do you stand on this? Do you think this will help the entire world get out of this pandemic?
Well, thank you so much, Hala. I think this issue of access to vaccines is very, very important. And one of the most troubling issues of our time, the fact that you have in the rich countries 66% or more of the population vaccinated, and let's take Africa, you have about 7%. That kind of inequity of access is what we really want to work hard to correct. And to do that, of course, you need several things to be in place. You need to have a manufacturing capacity diversified to many countries. Right now, 80% of exports are from 10 countries in the world. And so it's so concentrated. So we need to put more capacity in developing countries and emerging markets. We need, of course, the transfer of technology that you talked about, which is the issue of the intellectual property. That many members of the WTO are asking for a waiver. Over 100 developing countries are asking for this. On the other side, there are members who feel that this is not the answer to the pandemic. And what we need to do is bring them to the middle. This is a negotiating forum. And I think there are pragmatic solutions that we can come to that will give developing countries more access to this technology and to IP, whilst at the same time taking care of the worries of the developed that we should not disincentivize innovation. So I think that technology transfer is a big part of the issue. Manufacturing capacity is another part. And making sure that supply chains work. Because, manufacturing of vaccines requires very complex supply chains. There are many parts involved. And so making sure export prohibitions and restrictions are lowered and we facilitate trade. That's also important.
Now, you know very well the challenge of getting vaccines out to the developing world. You used to serve on the board of Gavi. Do you think there is there anything more innovative that you want to see happening? Because now you're in the big chair at the World Trade Organization. What is it you feel you're able to do now that you were calling for back when you were at Gavi?
I think what is innovative, in the short term, we need to work with manufacturers. If we help them to monitor their supply chains and make sure that goods flow freely, I think it would be very good to see them allow swapping of contracts between countries in the short term. That is, rich countries that are at the top of the queue because they have more money and can bid for supplies of vaccines, to swap contracts with poorer countries at the back of the queue. This is innovative. This is good. This will serve everybody. It's in everybody's interest to get everyone vaccinated worldwide. So that's something that we are working on: more transparency in contracting, more distribution, more equity. That's something that we dream of, we dreamt of when I was in Gavi and working on COVAX. And actually today there's news that Switzerland has agreed to swap its contract so that COVAX can get to the front of the line and get more vaccines and send to poorer countries, while Switzerland goes to the back of the queue. I think these are some of the kinds of solutions that we are working with manufacturers on. And then in the longer term, I think innovative is to go to those parts of the world that don't have the capacity to manufacture. I mean, it's anomalous that in Africa we import 99% of our vaccines and 90% of our medical products. So why don't we get investment in those parts of the world and make sure that they can manufacture for their own population?
Let's talk about your plans for the WTO. You have, of course, made history being the first woman, the first African to head up this organisation. You've talked about finding practical solutions and encouraging consensus. What are you hoping to do in terms of reforming this organisation? Because there have been criticisms that it's not been able to get as much done as people would like.
Well, thank you, Hala. I think this is actually a very important issue that will be center stage during this ministerial that we're going to start in a few days. I think, let me first correct the impression that, there's nothing new happening at the WTO. Yes, the organization has quite a few problems with its multilateral instrument in reaching agreements, and there are some agreements that have been pending for 20 years. But there are also some agreements that are being negotiated, some activities that are ongoing on very recent issues that are pertinent to our times. What am I talking about? Digital trade has taken off during this pandemic. And right now, there are 86 countries at the WTO negotiating rules that can underpin e-commerce. There are members who are negotiating rules on how to help women trade better and fit into global value chains so they can improve their incomes. Same with micro, medium, and small enterprises. So we do have some exciting things going on. In the area of climate change, we also have members who are working to see how can trade be part of the solution. Now, coming back to what you said, yes, it is true that we have not modernized some of our instruments for years. We've not been able to complete some multilateral negotiations in fisheries, for instance. There are negotiations that have been going on here for 21 years on how to reduce harmful fisheries subsidies that lead to overfishing. And so if we can, we are hoping that during this conference, we can have ministers reach an agreement finally after 21 years. To curb those harmful fisheries subsidies. In addition, I think we talked about reform. We need to update our negotiating instruments. We have to update our monitoring capacity and finally our dispute settlement system and modernize the way that we approach our rules in the organization. I think these are the things that will be discussed in this ministerial, and hopefully we'll make some progress along those lines.
Well, it's great to hear that you're hoping for some progress after 21 years on the issue of fisheries, particularly when environmental protection is top of most people's minds right now. But of course, the big cloud that looms over certainly the WTO in recent years has been this massive dispute between China and the United States. And when big disputes like this arise, how hopeful are you that we'll be able to come through them and get back to a more smoother way of trading internationally?
Well, Hala, you've pointed to the issue of, the tariff wars, the unilateral actions that some of our members have been taking, which, we are very hasty to let them know that any actions must be in accordance with WTO rules. So, of course, there have been tensions between China and the U.S., as you said, between U.S. and Europe. But you've seen recently that actually the United States and Europe have come together and settled some of their longstanding issues on steel tariffs. So that is very promising. And we hope that that can set an example of how members can bilaterally deal with each other and come to agreement without going to the dispute settlement system. That being said, geopolitical tensions are high, but I want to share something with you. Whilst we see the rhetoric is very hot, actually, when you look at the trade numbers, you will see that trade between the U.S. and China is very robust. And almost at an all-time peak. The same about trade between Europe and China. So sometimes what is actually happening on the ground pragmatically differs from the rhetoric that you hear geopolitically.
Okay. Director General of the World Trade Organization, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, thank you so much for joining us on Counting the Cost.
Thank you, Hala.
Now, for centuries, saffron has been a powerful component of the economy and culture in Indian-administered Kashmir. Temperatures have been rising, though, and rainfall is more erratic, threatening the future of this rare spice. Pavni Mittal reports.
It's the busiest time of year for saffron farmers. Mehrajuddin's family is harvesting purple flowers that only bloom for a week. They live in Indian-administered Kashmir's Pampore district and, like others here, have been farmers for generations. The last few years have been tough.
Production has been decreasing gradually. When I was younger, we used to harvest about 15 kilograms. Now we barely recover labor costs. It's because of the erratic rainfall and at times drought-like conditions. The government installed irrigation pumps but barely used them.
Saffron farming is hard work, but lucrative. Strands are individually plucked and piled up. 150,000 flowers can yield 1 kilogram of saffron, which sells for nearly $3,500. Now, the world's most expensive spice is staring at an uncertain future.
The demand for Kashmiri saffron has always exceeded supply, and the gap is getting wider. Production is down 30% on 2 decades ago. Filling in some of that shortfall in markets like these is saffron from Iran. It's cheaper to buy and sometimes sold as Kashmiri.
The government opened this facility last year to increase production. Until now, Riaz Ahmed Ganai's family dried strands the traditional way. Here, it's done by machines, which is quicker and maintains the quality. Scientists test the strands regularly and certify them.
We heard that saffron gets the GI tag here and is scientifically processed so we can sell it globally at a good price. Many farmers have produced lying in storage. I am impressed with the facilities and technology.
Bashir Elahi from the Saffron Research Center is telling farmers about new ways to sow and tend their crop. He also advises them on how to reduce the effects of climate change.
Rainfall patterns have changed and it's not happening at the right time. That's one of the main reasons behind the production decline. We have recommended a new irrigation schedule to the farmers.
Scientists say their methods can improve saffron quality and increase production by up to 40%. But many farmers are skeptical. They have little faith in the government and see their land as sacred. They say nature will look after them, like it has done for centuries.
And that is our show for this week. But remember, you can get in touch with us via Twitter. Tweet me at Hala Mohiuddin. Use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. or drop us an email, countingthecost@aljazeera.net. There's much more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That will take you straight to our page, which has entire episodes for you to catch up on. And that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Hala Mohyuddin from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news is next on Al Jazeera.